All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 11th episode of Hot Dogs and Caviar. I realized last week we told you you were going to hear Nate and I sort of having kind of a magazine episode where we discuss a bunch of different topics, a bunch of little things that wouldn't rate a whole episode. Yes, I said that was going to happen, but I lied because I got a special treat for y'all. Y'all have heard me mention, and Nate mentioned many times, our friend and mentor, Tarver Super King King. Probably the greatest natural cook I've ever met in my probably the greatest natural
he's the Willie Mays of the kitchen. He's the most naturally gifted, say hey kid, best natural cook I've ever worked with.
Like, also
he would trounce anybody in our like Mount Rushmore in a cooking battle. He would trounce them.
Yeah, the only reason the only reason he hasn't been more influential is that there is just absolutely no justice in this world.
Yep.
So we managed to get him on the podcast. Actually, it was his idea. He called us and was like, I want to do a podcast. I'm super excited. Also, unlike a lot of really great chefs who tend to be, what do you call them? Like jerks. Tarver has the unique quality of being incredibly talented, but also not a complete butthole, which is so rare. Like, so often, the most talented people are, like, egotistical prima donnas or bloody-minded psychos, whereas Tarver just happens to be this awesome guy who taught me and Nate so much about cuisine, and he's here now. This is him laughing constantly in the background.
He has the most infectious laugh in the universe, and I'm going to profess my love just for a second. Like, I cannot understate how much this guy has taught me about cuisine, but the most important thing I think I've learned from Tarver is he taught me a leadership style that I've still incorporated today, and so has Jesse. It's like, it's so much easier to be a wiener and a dick leader. You can get the results you need, but it's always for the wrong reason. He taught me how to be positive and encourage your cooks. And it's a lot harder that way, but it's the best way. And I owe that to Super King. No doubt about it.
I mean, when it comes
to one of the reasons why I wanted to be on this podcast so much is because you guys influenced me a huge amount. I mean, like, we cooked together. That was 2005, 2004.
I showed up in late 2006.
It was for 5 years.
Yeah. Been a long time.
I was only there for two of them.
Yeah, I mean, I've been cooking for a while before then, but that was like a complete turning point. Like, Nate, I bonded with you culinarily, is that the right term?
Yes.
A long time ago. And like, I have been looking for that type of camaraderie and I will be for the rest of my life. Like, that we delved into food. Like, there was a hunger in your eyes that I saw the first day I met you, and you had no compromises. You were absolutely hilarious doing it, but you were so passionate, and I had never met anyone like that before in my entire life. Like, there's lots of cooks that I worked with in the past that were passionate and really into it, but you wanted to know everything, and you wanted to be around people that wanted to know everything, and you wanted to try everything. And that was really awesome to be around. And as those years went on, Jesse, you came in a couple years later, but there were some people in that kitchen at that time that we were all the same. I mean, and there's been some greats. I mean, we were just talking about it a second ago with Smiley, David Breeden. You know, he's like one of the, you know, he's the top dog at French Laundry now. Logan Cox, that guy is a amazing, amazing chef. You know, he's got Homer out there out west. Dustin Busby. I mean, like, there's so many people that have gone through those doors, especially in that time, that era. Like, I would put those years of the Woodlands at that was its peak.
I feel like I was part of the decline. but no, you had a
no, man.
No, dude.
Yeah, no, it was just such a great culture, and that was a big reason I wanted to drive up there and go work in Somerville, was just to be a part of, just be around people that I wanted to be like,
Sheree
and learn.
McDowell,
like,
Emily
they know Kirsten. Something that like, I don't, and I want to know it. And
yeah.
And that culture just kind of kept spreading, and we carried the torch. And
In the FOH, Stéphane Pelletier and Hugues Lebert, there was so much to learn from those two dudes. Who
oh, my God.
Those are the most amazing
out-of-the-house
professionals I've ever worked with in my life.
Yeah, and they were
Stéphane is genius.
And yeah. Ooh, ooh,
they're awesome.
Ooh could work 18-hour days every day and still just kind of be chilled out and happy, and that's amazing.
Like machine.
He's C-3PO.
He's a machine. Yeah.
He's totally C-3PO.
But he was so good at it. He's so good at it.
And the thing
is, like a
front of the house robot android that was just built for this.
Yeah. Well, I had a funny story from the Woodland Times. I know you like to start the episodes out with one.
You are the guest of honor. Let's do this.
Take it away, brother.
There's a lot of really, really, really funny stories, but I know, like, you know, you kind of have to keep things somewhat censored, you know, that kind of thing. The funniest story that I can remember, and Sheree and I were kind of laughing about it because, you know, you had mentioned us on a couple episodes ago, and Sheree was talking about this time, and I don't know if you remember the Russian, I think he was like a valet or something. I think his name was Vlad, and he had a thick, deep Russian accent. Uh-huh. And he was like a teenager. I think he was like 19.
Ukrainian, but close enough.
Ukrainian. Okay. And he had a head over heels crush for this girl who was working in concierge, you know, and he was talking to Sheree like, I need advice. I want to ask her out and stuff like that. And Sheree was going to help him. She made him like some chocolate covered strawberries. Noreen let him borrow like a wine bucket so he could put a bottle of champagne in it with some wine glasses, and he got flowers. And the thing about it, for the listeners to know, is that the Woodlands was in the woods. And the way that the employees would go from the inn to the parking lot was down this dark road. Yeah. And at nighttime, it was dark. And she was like, you know, you should just surprise her. And like, obviously, and like, you should just surprise her with champagne and strawberries and stuff like that. Anyway, the next day he comes in, he's looking sad. He brought the wine bucket back, and Sheree was like, you know, how'd it go? And he's like, it don't work. It didn't work. She run from me. And she was like, what? And apparently he pulled up to her as she was walking by herself down this dark road in a white van, opened the sliding door and said, do not be frightened, get into my van. And she screamed and took off running. And it was flowers and chocolates and all this stuff. And he was like, you know, all upset. She was terrified running down the road. Felt horrible for the guy. We were losing it. We were absolutely losing it. Sheree wanted me to also mention the story that Nate mentioned a couple episodes ago with the turkey rolling into the goddamn woods. Sheree was with you when you were when that happened. She, like, you had a bunch of sheep hands too, and like you fell, you were furious. Nate rage is a spectacle to see. Like, it's scary, but it's also like kind of funny. Yeah, it could be really funny, but Sheree came into the kitchen first, and she was like, look, Nate's upset. Do not laugh. He fell. Don't say anything. Don't do anything. And we were all just like already starting to like already holding back the tears of laughter. And you came in, and I think it was and I think it was Buzzy. He was like, Nate, are you okay? And you're like, no! Turkey went rolling into the goddamn woods. I'm suing this fucking place.
You were at your little work table facing the back door, and I was next to you because there was nothing going on. So,
it was hilarious.
We were involved in some prep project. You were demoing something, and the reason I remember is because you looked like you were going to explode. Like, Nate comes storming into the kitchen. You just looked at me and was like, I'm not going to make it. I had forgotten. Oh, there's nothing funny.
Yeah, but that was, but Nate rage is like, is absolutely, Nate rage is like, it can be funny, but like that impassioned aspect of you, Nate, is something that has driven me your anger and your rage, Nate, is a spectacle. It's absolutely hilarious, but like, it's one of the things that I admire about you. It's like a marker of how passionate you are. You know, you will not stop until you figure something out and learn it, and you'll get angry as shit about it if you can't figure it out. I think it's
a blessing and a curse, and sometimes I boil over.
I gotta say,
for sure,
the thing that because I got to come in there, you guys already knew each other well, you trusted each other,
we clicked pretty fast.
Yeah.
So I got to watch that kitchen in action, and for me, like, what really got to me with it was that, like, I've worked in serious kitchens in Chicago. Most notably, I worked for Grant Atkins at Trio, and you'd think there would have been more of that attitude there. I'm not knocking that place by any stretch, but Grant was brand new, and he was very much trying to put his stamp on things. So it was very much about realizing his vision. It was less about learning what you want to learn, and more about figuring out the crazy stuff that he wanted us to do, which was good, and especially because I was 22, so I didn't have an opinion about anything. I was an idiot. getting to Woodlands and seeing you guys work together, first off, the spirit of learning, like how you were just aggressive, Tarver, you especially were like, if you want to learn how to do this, you should learn to do it. Like, we'll put anything on the menu you want. And I was just like, wait, really? It was such a departure from the way that I knew before. But I remember watching you guys, and you were discussing ice filtration, which I'd never heard of. I think that came out of Fat Duck. So, but you guys were having You guys were having a conversation about making a consommé by ice filtration, and discussing the nuts and bolts of how you were doing it. And then Nate looks over at you, perfectly serious, and goes, "Well, what if I pee in it?" And you're like, "Well, if you pee in it, that might help the protein balance, but it might adversely affect the flavor." And Nate just goes, "All right, I might not pee in it." And this was like, he never shifted out of the serious conversation.
We never cracked. Yeah.
We never broke character. And I was like, beautiful British method actors.
It was pH.
I was just trying to keep everybody on their toes.
It totally would have changed the pH. It wouldn't have worked.
The gelatin would have broke down. It wouldn't have grabbed all the impurities. And pee freezes at a different temperature than consommé. Well, so.
Plus, like the yellow color.
Oh yeah, yeah. The urine.
There's an interesting conversation. Consommé removes impurities, right? So if somebody peed in some stock and then you made consommé with it, would you taste it? Like, if it's removing impurities.
I don't know.
I'll try anything once. Wait, who's pee? Who's pee? Can it be my own pee?
Can I use deer pee and then go hunting? Like, clarify deer piss. All right, all you hunters out there. That deer pee is good? Squirt some of this on your neck. They'll be running for you.
Right. Snap into a Yankee biscuit.
All right, this is excellent. Darvish, to the guest of honor, you had spoken about wanting to sort of take us through some of the things that came out of that period during the Woodlands and how they affected your process moving forward. So I just want to green light for that, man. Take us through it.
Yes. On one of those things, they're like kind of, you could kind of separate the things that we really delved into: technique, ingredient sourcing. That's where, like, at least for me, that's when foraging really started, in my career. The modernist techniques, you can kind of put all that kind of stuff in there. I have a little bit of a dispute or bone to pick with you, Jesse. A couple of episodes ago, when you were talking about ingredients, and you're like, these are the best ingredients and these suck, I hate these ingredients. You said you hated cream cheese.
I do.
I don't get that. I love cream cheese so much. I can hear the surprise in Nate's voice too when you said it. So the only reason I bring that up now, there was a few like very simple things, like gnocchi, for example. Like, we went through hundreds of different techniques, different breeds of potato, temperature, salt, moisture, everything. And we ended up with a gnocchi ace up the sleeve that, like, I still pull out now. The gnocchi flour, the ratio of the flour and everything. Like, the gnocchi that we came up with then is still an ace up my sleeve now. But it's something that you could just give that recipe to someone, you know, potato, egg, and water, salt, and like, yeah, they wouldn't really understand how to do it, you know, but it's the technique involved. The what I'm getting to is Nate, the pomme gâteau. It was just potatoes and salt, but it was a technique of temperature. We tried different fats, everything. But Jesse, we use that pomme gâteau sometimes, and like one of the most stellar renditions of it was we whipped cream cheese with truffle, and it was like piped inside the pomme gâteau. So it was like super hot and crunchy on the outside and like creamy, soft, beautiful, silky potato on the inside. And then when you cut into it, it was like this beautiful cream cheese that came out. And when you said cream cheese, I was like, no. Like I had like a meltdown. Like I was like freaking out. So I do understand where you're coming from on that, but like there are applications for everything.
Yeah, I mean, I like I like bagel and cream cheese with smoked salmon as much as the next guy. Like I'm not against cream cheese. What I'm against is lazy
bleedy caviar and oh my god.
What I'm against is lazy chefs blowing cream cheese into ragouts because they can't be bothered to make the emulsion proper.
Oh,
like that's
absolutely
like,
yeah.
It's a crutch. Yeah, that's where I was coming from, and it's specifically it's that place I worked in New Orleans with the Tetris boss, and we had this dish that was like Israeli couscous, scallions, andouille, and cream cheese folded together and used as a base for grilled fish, and it was just the easiest, laziest thing I've ever seen. And
yeah,
did it taste good? Sure, Coors Light tastes good, and I wouldn't feature it in a 5-star restaurant like. Cheetos.
My dad would like that. That'd be all right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that was a very. Also, there was that extremely hacky cream cheese and foie gras mousse that I learned to make in Chicago, where I honestly, more than anything, I was like scandalized and annoyed by how perfectly it worked. It was a really good banquet foie gras mousse because you could have it out for hours and it wouldn't flop. And it's because it wasn't mousse. Mousse means foam. And this wasn't mousse. This was just cream cheese and torchon mixed 50-50. And I was like, this tastes great, but it feels wrong. So also, we're provocateurs, man. If I put everything on the list that I thought wouldn't annoy anybody, I mean, I could have just listed off ingredients that no one should use. Like, I don't know, French onion soup mix or something like that. But...
I can't tell you the amount of people that I know that could not cook without that shit.
Oh, dude.
Their minds would explode if you took away their onion soup mix. Their whole recipe book would be trashed.
Jesus.
But yeah, so that's where I was coming from. And that thing that you talk about with the pumpkin actually sounds really nice. But I'm not gonna
lie. It was amazing. It was that pomme gâteau. I mean, sans cream cheese, that was just kind of like a funny thing, but like that pomme gâteau is a perfect example of what came out of our time at the Woodlands. Like all that was just potato, salt, and that's it. And so, we like it's not something everyone can do. It took a massive amount of research and practice to figure that out. I think it was beautiful.
That sounds delicious.
And that's one of the things too that I've always embraced, and I try to teach other young cooks is like information is not knowledge. Like there is so much information out there. You can get any recipe, but it doesn't mean you know how to do it. Like some
you can get overloaded
or more than just the formula. Like you got to touch it, you got to feel it. Like the gnocchi, like I could give you a recipe. Sure, you won't be able to do it as good unless we make it with you like 10 times.
That gnocchi's perfect. Perfect. Like I've cooked that gnocchi for
the nuances, and you gotta feel it. I can't explain it. You gotta touch it.
It's timing. Yeah, it's timing. Everything.
Yeah.
I've had like phenomenal, like just the gnocchi alone, and it's like, yeah, I know. It took a long time to figure that out.
You're so right, though.
We spoke last week about cookbooks that bugged us. And one of the cookbooks that we discussed bugging us was the grandma cookbooks, like The Joy of Cooking at Fanny Farmer, where they're like a $10 cookbook with like 500 recipes in it. It's like you can't communicate 500 recipes in a single book. Like the less information in each recipe, the more stuff you're not getting. That's what makes the In Search of Perfection book so remarkable, is that's a 250-page book.
Oh, my God.
8 recipes in it. Like, there's, you know.
Yeah, dude, he uses an MRI machine to show how the marinade goes into chicken for tikka masala. I mean, like, yeah, like Nate touched on, like, they went all over the place finding, like, researching the pH in the water in Italy for their pizza. Yeah. I mean, the steak.
Not just how, but why. Why?
Yeah, why? Like, yeah. As much as the end result, like, ended up with, like, a roast chicken that took 24 hours to cook, but, like, unbelievably good. Or the beef with, like, the – do you remember the beef one?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that was absolutely – it took, like, 24 – yeah, the blue cheese butter. I mean, yeah. My God, man, that was amazing.
Blue cheese butter. We did the chicken out of that book with Sylvia's milk-fed poussin.
Yes.
Unbelievable. It was took forever. Yes. But it was so good. We were injecting.
It was unreal.
And I burned my skull. Yeah. I was like flicking it like Dr. Evil, and the syringe like shot up, and it burned my bald head so bad.
Oh my God, that was hysterical.
Yeah, that was really funny.
You were like, ah! Jeez. So we found Spice House when we were at Woodlands. I mean, that's still something to this day. I will say, like, one quick thing on the joy of cooking. I agree with you for a lot of it, but have you seen the earlier editions? Like, I think I have the 3rd or 4th.
No, They took
a lot out that they should put back in. That really gave that book its bones. Dude, like, how to hunt, skin, and prepare squirrel. Is in it.
Really?
I mean, okay. Yeah, like there's a lot. Cool. Yeah, that book has some like real heritage to it.
I
that
have, like,
really kind of
the
10th
edition,
it.
The revision, and you know how they.
Oh, are. Yeah. You should look, go try and find one of the older ones. Okay. I found it in next to an airport. I think it was in New York or Chicago. I don't remember where it was. It was some airport, Atlanta maybe. And there was like this random bookstore with like old used books. And I was like waiting for a flight. And I was like going through these books. And it was like, and it's only this big. Like the joy of cooking now is like this giant thing.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's only like 8 inches tall. And I was like, oh, wow, look at this old joy of cooking. And it was the 3rd edition. And I was kind of flipping through it. And like I flipped by this, like, you know, pulling the skin off of a squirrel like diagram. And I was like, what? That's not normal. And like I bought it. Brought it home and I was researching. There's so much in that they took out, thinking that your everyday cook wouldn't be messing with, and it really,
it
like, I mean, Hannibal Lecter
and dumb it down.
Yeah,
but a lot of it got lost in the translation too. Like
Jesse, it really did.
We're talking about if you're not at grandma's apron strings, learning the nuances of those recipes, like you're dumb.
Yeah,
the cookies chapter is awesome. Like
that sounds phenomenal.
They got great cookies.
The sauce chapter is actually not that bad too. Like it really kind of talks about like developing sauce work, like, you know, like layering in flavors as you make a sauce that like is still pretty good. Yeah. I give it another, like, I agree with you. Don't get me wrong. Like it's definitely like a homebody kind of thing. And it's not like a super necessary thing for your cooks in your professional kitchens now, but it is something worth taking a look at least for the heritage of it. Like it's a beautiful thing.
The other reason that it interests me less is like, I don't mind a grandma cookbook, but what I really gravitate to are like regional junior league cookbooks because they have so much more regional focus. Like, I've got a decent junior league cookbook collection, like New Orleans and Baton Rouge and Charleston, everywhere I've ever lived. But then in Louisiana, I started collecting just junior league cookbooks from like, I'm going to mispronounce it. I think it's Natashar or something like that. Like Nakacha, like these towns with these French / Native American names that are completely unpronounceable. They all have their own junior league cookbook and they all have very unique, cool stuff. Mm-hmm. I also have a cookbook that my grandmother gave me for Christmas or I inherited when she died. I'm really not clear on remembering when it happened, but it was from like the Wives Club cookbook from a naval base in Panama from like 1950. So it was like a bunch of Navy wives that were in charge of whose husbands were in charge of the Panama Canal put together a recipe book. So it's on the one hand kind of like 50s housewife cuisine, but on the other hand using all Panamanian ingredients. So super
tropical
everything. Like I find that like if you're going to be mining cookbooks that have compromised recipes, it's more interesting to go chase down stuff with legit regional character. And that's kind of...
Absolutely.
There's so much... I mean, I mean, obviously, we both know my cookbook collection's better than Nate's.
Challenge accepted. Yeah. When my grandmother handed me down her cookbook collection, like she gave me like a bunch of really antique stuff.
She was in the business, right? She was like an editor or something. Yeah, like
dude,
that.
You mentioned Jeffrey.
Tell all the listeners about your grandmother and her relationship with some other famous people. It is incredible.
You mentioned Jeffrey Steingarten in the last episode. My grandmother was Jeffrey Steingarten before Jeffrey Steingarten. Like she was the food editor for Vogue magazine.
That's awesome.
In the 60s. She was friends with Julia Child and James Beard. She wrote a few cookbooks of her own, which are stellar. I mean, I could talk about her all day. Unfortunately, she passed before I could, you know, really. I wish she was around now. That'd be amazing. But my mom tells me stories about my grandmother, like, you know, foraging for chestnuts to cook, you know, with some wild pheasant that night, you know, and for dinner. I mean, like she would like forage for greens, for salads and stuff like that. She was amazing. I mean, she was so far ahead of her time, but she had a cookbook collection of her own that I got handed down to me. Like I'm extremely fortunate. Like there's a Vincent Price cookbook awesome. That she gave me. Yeah. Like that Vincent Price and someone else wrote together, but there's the oldest book that I have that she found somewhere is 206 years old, and it's like 1001 ways to cook an egg, and it's incredibly, incredibly cool. There's some things in there that are like, I'll never do that, but that's pretty cool, you know. But you know, some like a lot of apicious kind of stuff.
With those old cookbooks, you really got to strip mine them. Like the thing
you
about,
do.
The thing about a new cookbook, like a Thomas Keller cookbook, will just give it all up to you. But an old cookbook really requires some commitment to get to the bottom of.
Like, it's not written the same way. It's like, take a spoon of this and a flagon of ale here, you know, or a glass of... It's not like a tablespoon or a measure of any kind. Like, we have this 17th century wine cake that we still use every now and then as the ace of the sleeve, but that was measured like that. Like, a glass of this wine, a splash of sherry here, but it is... phenomenal. You're right. You got to cherry pick them.
But you know, you talked about Steingarten. My favorite individual article from Steingarten's body of work, and I don't remember whether it was in The Man Who Ate Everything or it must have been Something I Ate, but he's talking about pie crust, and he takes Marion Cunningham's recipe from the Fanny Farmer cookbook, which is incomplete.
Yeah.
And he goes and sits with her while she makes it. And he wrote an annotated copy of that recipe that was like 10 times longer than the one in the Fanny Farmer cookbook.
Yeah.
And the thing is, that really illustrates the problem with those old books is that his version was 5,000 words, while her version was like 250 words. But if you do his, if he's doing her recipe, he's just like, I watched her do it. My pie crust turned a corner that day when I read that. I always kind of struggled with American style pie crust, partly because I'm not a baker, but also partly because it's a pain in the ass. Like you've got it's so much about touch and feel. And so he was talking about like exactly how large to make the butter globules. Like he's like, some should be as small as peas. Some should be as large as like postage stamps. And I was just like,
I always thought it would be kind of interesting to find out like how much was left on the cutting room floor of all those old books, like printing ink was at a premium. Like it cost mega dollars to print a book.
A lot.
And, you know, even the real estate on the page was at a premium. Like I always wondered too, like if the editors and, you know, the printers like forced the author's hand, like I wonder how pissed off they are too. Like, it's not even the whole recipe. Like they're not going to be able, they don't know to chill the butter. They don't know to grate it. They don't know.
Like some musician.
And, you have an 8x5 space. That's it.
Yeah.
You have 30 words.
That's a really good
point. Yeah. Make it work.
That's a really, really good point.
Knowing that, I have that knowledge to relook at something like The Joy of Cooking. Cause it comes from a very, very long time ago.
Good point.
Yeah.
But once again, I will admit that a lot of that was being a provocateur. Like if I didn't think that some of
Paul's
opinions would annoy people, I wouldn't have said it. For instance, when Nate and I took a run at Dornberg and Page in culinary artistry.
Yeah.
I have culinary artistry, and I kind of liked culinary artistry.
So do I. Yeah,
What I didn't like is that when that book was such a success, the only thing that people were really reacting to was, in my opinion, the lamest part of it, which was the database of ingredients that go with other ingredients. So their next couple of books were just that. I liked the fanciful articles, you know, chefs talking about their desert island ingredients, or like chefs talking about the best menu they ever cooked. Like, there's a lot of really cool stuff in there. Well, cool might be the wrong word, but there's a lot of really nifty stuff in there. But then, you know, it's like there was a specific thing about it that enraged me, and that's kind of why we went down that road.
Yeah. I like lists. Yeah. I like databases. I think they're helpful. Sure. I'm not going to say I've never used one. Absolutely. I look at them and I think they're cool. But I think the unintended consequences of that book, or I think they intended it this way because they know people are lazy. It's like
by nature.
Chefs who used it as a crutch and that's their only inspiration, like, come on, man.
The thing that really resonates with me is tradition. Like, I like traditional cuisine. Even if you're doing something modernistic, stuff resonates with me more if it has a sort of grounding in time and place. Like, if a dish has all...
That's how the In Search of Perfection really stands out, because those are traditional things. I mean, he takes, you know, simple things like pizza, roast chicken, tikka masala, you know, and
they're
takes a modern
for
approach.
A reason. I get it.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going anywhere. No one... Yeah. Bolognese and tikka masala and pizza, they're not going anywhere.
Nowhere. I mean, and we looked at doing a cookbook when we were at Woodlands. I mean, I don't know if you remember that, but like we were talking to, well, I think it was Penguin, but we were looking at about a, yeah, we're, oh, really? Yeah, it was, we were looking at about 100, I think it was like 100 to 150,000 to get it started.
Yeah, it's really expensive.
It was a jump.
When I was
Marty Wall did not go for it.
when I was with the Pugins group, I actually got tasked with helping write their cookbook, and that's actually the reason I took the job and stayed with them so long. And at the end of the day, it was a cool project, and I was excited about it. It just wasn't cost effective. Like it would have been a miracle to make money with that. Like a miracle.
Yeah.
And the cool thing nowadays, though, too, is like the keys to the castle are going away. Like, if you want to publish a book, you can print it on demand and like you can publish your own. It's not cheap, but it's way cheaper and it's doable. So if you have the will, you're not going to need like six figures to get it off the ground.
Yeah.
Will you make money? That's still a crapshoot, but you can do it.
You're not going to need
six figures.
But on the other hand, either you will have a professional photographer that will be extremely expensive, or the photography will take years. Like, there are still huge expenses involved with traditional publishing.
Yeah.
However,
and just like you're saying, Nate, like when we were looking at doing a cookbook at Woodlands all the way back then, we had to make an initial order of, I think it was like 5,000 books was the minimum, you know, just to have, you know, it was not print on demand.
And that's actually been a new thing. A friend of mine is an amateur cartoonist. And she prints her book 60 copies at a time. Like if she's going
is she to- the one that you had draw things on a chef coat for me?
No, that was a different friend of mine. This is
oh, okay.
The friend I refer to now, her name's Kathy Peterson, and I went to college with her and high school, actually, for that matter. Who is she draws a comic strip called Kidnapped by Gnomes. That is
awesome.
Hard to explain, but I'll just give a plug. Go check out Kidnapped by Gnomes. It's a webcomic, so it's free. But she sells hard copies of the books at comic conventions. And interestingly enough, she's kind of mentoring me because I'm in the almost finished scripting a graphic novel. And so she's driving me to sort of go to conventions and meet artists and try to get the thing drawn. And so that's going to – that's a whole different topic. But so she's been super instrumental with that. But my point is she prints, you know, 60, 70 copies of the book at a time and then goes to a comic convention, sells, you know, 12 of them and thinks, OK, well, I guess I almost made my money back. This is fun. And then right back to it. No, the other friend, the one who drew the wieners on the chef jacket, that's my friend, Lynn.
Yeah.
She is.
That was awesome. I still have it. It's hilarious. I pull it out and show people. It's great.
You know what? That's a funny story. That's a funny story we should get into. So Charleston Food and Wine used to give you a chef jacket every time you participated, which was great for me because that means every time I participated, it was another day without dry cleaning. I was like, all right, another day. And they were nice. They were lightweight and they had a pretty applique on them. I mean, like, they were.
It's a nice jacket.
It's a nice jacket. They were like Egyptian cotton. They were super light. So they were like nice and breezy. So I got a bunch of them. But on the other hand, once you've done five or six of those events, you're just like, oh, another damn chef jacket. So you just sort of discard it. And you're like, Tarver came and did an event with us for Food and Wine 1 year and then left his jacket, either by mistake or because he didn't care about it. It doesn't matter.
Was that the mystery dinner, mystery ingredient dinner?
I don't remember what it was. I just remember you were our guest for our guest chef for our Charleston Food and Wine back when you were allowed to have guest chefs that weren't on TV. Yes, I'm editorializing a little bit. Hey, Charleston Food and Wine, smarten up. You used to be cool. I'm leaving that in unless somebody nice really doesn't want me to.
Whatever.
So he left his jacket, and we were just like, Nate's like, oh, do we send this to Tarver? And I was like, does he even care? And then Nate goes, we could draw wieners all over it, then send it to Tarver. And then Lynn, who was right there, she's like a server assistant, but she happens to be a really strong artist. She goes, I could draw wieners all over it and then send it to Tarver. And we were like, now you're talking. That is a good
job.
So she
did a very, very good job. If she's listening, like, that is, I cherish it. It's absolutely hysterical and awesome.
She did themed wieners. Like, there was a pimp one that had.
Yeah, there's a tank totem one.
Yeah, the tank, yeah. I remember. That was yeah.
She did a pro wrestler one for me.
It's the wrestler. Yeah.
And, like, I cannot overemphasize how great the artwork was. And it wasn't particularly poor.
It was good.
They were clearly cartoony. So we she did that. It took her about 4 days. I mean, she did it incredibly fast. And then she brought the jacket back and we mailed it to Tarver. And then we kind of forgot about it because it was like, oh, okay, we have done a funny thing. And
I fell out of my chair. I was laughing so hard.
He calls the kitchen or calls my phone. I can't remember which one. He's just like, apparently Tarver has received the jacket. He's like, I'm in the middle of doing a 200% event and I can't because I haven't been able to stop laughing for 15 minutes. That's epic. A thing of beauty. You should send a bunch of
that was so good.
We'll put them on the blog. I think that was great. And then
I will.
It's not X-rated. It's just, it's goofy. It's like nothing.
No, it's parody. It's awesome.
It's definitely not pornographic. It's definitely
cartoon.
Yeah, it has
nothing to do with sex or anything. It's just,
I mean, they are dicks.
Olds having fun.
It's nothing racier than you'd see if you went to Spencer's Gifts and just looked around for a little bit.
Yeah, that's in the mall.
Yeah. that was so funny. She actually, every one of those that she actually drew like a picture of first on paper, as like a proof. And so this is like, she's like one of my best friends. We this is when we were just starting to hang out and she's like, hey, I wanted to know, do you want the originals of the cartoon wieners? And I was like, yeah, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
Like how could I possibly not want those? And she was like kind of embarrassed. Like she thought I might think it was funny, but she also didn't want to presume that I would even care about it. And I was like, are you nuts? Yes. So she brought the originals to me. So I have them. So that is one of my most prized possessions is the original cartoon wiener series.
We need to put that on the blog.
Oh yeah.
Hot dogs and caviar, blogspot.com.
Hot dogs and caviar. In this case, you know what? Let's just go ahead and say for the record that they are cartoon hot dogs.
Okay. Yeah. I like that.
Cartoon hot dogs.
They're definitely not.
Each equipped with a couple of meatballs.
all wearing a helmet.
They're jars of caviar.
Remember the drag queen?
They're like 28-gram jars of caviar.
Yeah. the going out on the town.
The drag queen wiener that itself had a meatball.
Yeah. Like, hey. Yeah. Oh my God.
I'm gonna step in with my role as moderator. We are now about halfway through.
Yeah, we're way off subject.
So right. I'm just gonna say, let's try to steer back to a little bit more culinary technical information because we have one of I think, one of the most exciting chefs in America on the podcast right now, which, well, much as I would love to talk about cartoon peni for the entire rest of the podcast, I feel like that might not be the best that might not be the best use of our listeners.
No.
Yeah. We want to know what ingredients are you crushing on right now? Like, are there anything that you're like been really, really digging on, really crushing on lately? I mean, not necessarily new, anything. Like, what have you been up to, man?
The most immediate, and this probably I'll have to go before this, but like the most immediate is kombu from Hokkaido because of you. But
I read that clean.
It's versatile. Almost kind of like a cucumber like aroma to it. Absolutely
super,
stellar.
Super subtle. Like, I put it in my pickles, I put it in my stock, I put it in all kinds of stuff just to like add a little depth, a little umami, satiety. Like, you'd never know it was in there unless I told you. Because I remember you used to candy it, and that was phenomenal.
So good, dude. So good.
I was like, candied kombu? That's good.
I missed that one. That sounds awesome.
Dude, it's so good. It's like sweet and salty. I mean, like salty things candied. You just have to blanch it a couple times.
It's a great garnish, a great little accessory kind of accent point to dishes.
Yeah. Have you heard of an ingredient called, I'm going to mispronounce this, Agostino Recalcitrata?
Yes.
Yes. Colatura?
Italian fish sauce? Yeah. Yes. Dude, Italian fish sauce, huge boner for it right now.
It's
like
so
ferments
clean.
In general. So clean, and it's like aged long enough so it's not like aggressive, you know. It's rounded. It's absolutely stellar. Like, it's been kind of hard to find, but you can actually get it on Amazon now.
You can get anything from Amazon.
It's crazy.
I'm actually working on a dish with that right now. Like, as in, it's half prepped in my freezer. I took a lamb leg and cut it down into its... Okay, so I have a lamb leg recipe that I like to do where you put garlic, rosemary, and anchovies into a bunch of slits all over it. And that's just like my go-to lamb leg.
Yeah.
Like, just for roasted lamb leg. So I want to do that. So I'm going to do a lamb leg carpaccio. So I took, seamed the lamb out and did like little roulades in plastic wrap, just like you're doing any carpaccio. And Dee's not eating raw meat right now, which I can't blame her. There was a bit of a medical scare last year. I'm going to take them and sear them on the outside. So there's no there's no raw. They're just very, very rare. Slice them thin. And then remember the rosemary mayo that we used to make, where you just steep like oil and rosemary.
That's from the In a Little Washington, man. That thing is stellar.
That
is amazing. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
So I was just saying the garlic, anchovy, and rosemary were the three flavors I wanted to incorporate. So the pickled garlic, like we do, Nate's recipe is really solid and utilitarian. And then
I got something to say about the pickled garlic. Please go ahead.
I was just gonna lay out carpaccio and then put dots of the rosemary. First, brush it with colatura. Instead of salt, just brush it with colatura, and then dots of the rosemary aioli and little slivers of pickled garlic. And do like a lamb leg, anchovy, rosemary, colatura, carpaccio. That's something I'm currently actively working on.
That sounds
Dude, ironically, I don't know if it's ironic, but I never understand the meaning of that word, but because I'm dumb. But the rosemary. Yeah, I know. The rosemary mayo that came from the inn was from that lamb carpaccio from that old school one.
Okay.
So you're on the, you're like-minded with Patrick O'Connell right now. So, I mean, that lamb carpaccio was one of the best dishes at the Inn of Little Washington. I want this to go on record. They have iconic dishes that have been on for very long periods of time. Right now, they're doing a lamb carpaccio that's been there for a while with it's got Caesar salad ice cream, which sounds weird, but it's actually really, really tasty.
I'd crush the
lamb carpaccio that preceded that carpaccio, in my book, was one of the best dishes out of the Inn of Little Washington kitchen ever. I mean, it is amazing. It's the lamb carpaccio, rosemary mayonnaise, tabbouleh, mint, and exceptional olive oil. It's just like one of the greatest things ever.
That place is so underrated.
It's my mouth. I'm like drooling all over my beard right now just thinking about it.
That is still the best kitchen. That is still the most amazing kitchen I've ever set foot in.
Have you seen the new? They just renovated.
Incredible. I saw a picture. So the guy who designed the Inn at Little Washington kitchen designed the kitchen at 492 where I was the chef, and I would still just fanboy over that place. He was like, thanks, man.
Russ from Next Step Design?
Yep.
I'm working with him right now. He's designing our kitchen.
Tell him I said what's
dude,
up.
Dude, I will. He is.
Russell.
Yeah, he's awesome. Yeah, we
he
just
knows everybody.
Yeah, we just took a trip to Atlanta to visit this metal worker who's like building us a hearth and a whole range suite. What? He told me not to say this guy's name, and I won't out of respect to Russ, but like this guy, we'll call him John, it's not his name, is a metal worker from Denmark that is beyond brilliant. Beyond brilliant. This guy is created this whole modular system for hearths, for wood cooking that is brilliant. I mean, one of the first things I asked him when I was looking at some of his completed pieces, I'll send you some images. I was like, is this stuff patented? And he was like, no, I won't patent it. If it's somebody tried to copy me, I just shame them online. He's a really awesome dude. I mean, but it's just him and like one or two other people. And they are, I mean, everything down to the knobs, the handles, the chains, I could fill this entire podcast talking about this guy, but he's going to be making us some equipment for our kitchen that's going to be.
Well, speaking of that, tell us about what you're working on, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we got a project going in Paeonian Springs. It's going to be called Waverly Springs. Paeonian Springs has a history of healing, and that's really what the whole shtick is of this. There's a spring there that it all the way back to like to the early 1700s was reputed to have restorative properties. They used to ship this water all over the country, lots of DC politicians were drinking, all that kind of stuff. I mean, there's a lot of hocus pocus. It was just really good water. But that's where the name Paeonian came from the Greek god Paeon, the god of healing. It's a beautiful 20-acre property. It was built in 1735, and we're renovating it. It's going to be a country inn with like a very, you know, low-key mellow spa, you know, tent. It's going to be 14 rooms in total. They were renovating these horse stables into the actual restaurant itself. But we have the head gardener for Monticello, who's designing our show garden.
What?
He's going to be doing like some of the vegetable. Yeah, for our show garden. We're taking on to our team this other farmer who we're gonna invest in, and he's gonna have 5 acres down the road. He does a lot of CSAs in the area. Like we're very much in the country. He does a lot of CSAs in the area, but he's gonna grow all of our bulk, like, you know, potatoes, garlic, onion, you know, that kind of stuff that we use in the restaurant. We're like tons of land that we're foraging on. We're talking, and you guys should know this. There's a Nate Shapiro is working on this part of the project right now, but there's a place down south of us that will come out and inoculate our trees so we can grow our own truffles. So we have our own truffles on the property and everything. Yeah, it's gonna be awesome, dude. Like it's all like based off of being restorative and cleansing, but more not health food by any mean. Like that just more of like a mental mindset, like regenerating ourselves. We're looking to open in spring of next year, and you know, it should be perfect timing with pandemic and all that kind of stuff really winding down and all that.
Kidnap a Kennedy? Like, who's funding all this?
Friends, man. Like, it's some friends that we've been cooking for at Patamac Farm for a few years.
That's awesome. Awesome, man.
Absolutely amazing people. We're just, you know, it's 6 of us that are partners. And they are just very passionate, very down to earth, very, very good. And we're all very like-minded. Like, we just want to create something that will outlast us, that will, you know, really be able to shoot for the stars. Like, we're going for 3 Michelin stars for sure.
That's awesome,
man. Pardon my ignorance, so is this in West Virginia or Virginia?
Virginia, Northern Virginia. It's Paley Springs is a very small town. The closest thing to it, which is also really small, is Waterford, or, you know, near Leesbury. It's about like 45-50 minutes outside of DC.
Okay.
But yeah, it's off the beaten path. I mean, it's in the middle of the woods.
So
it's
exciting,
like rolling hills.
Man.
Yo, man, dude, this
congrats
is something I've been dreaming of for
the
whole life.
And
yeah, it's gonna be awesome, man. We're
incredible.
Extremely excited. Yeah.
And what are you
We've
doing
been trying
in
to
the
keep
meantime? Just R&D?
Research. R&D. Yeah, we're doing like private little, you know, functions here and there for you know, higher ups, that kind of thing. But mostly R&D, like just doing a ton of research. We're trying to figure out We're trying to go through the whole family tree of the owners of the property, like the original owner, like all the way through. Like, there is some serious history to the property, the town, and we're trying to, you know, really document everything and really incorporate that into the experience of eating and that kind of thing. You know, the same thing like we did with Patamac Farm, we really tapped into the place, like the history and all that kind of stuff. Like, we, one of the things that, you know, Gavin, the partner, always talked about was this one course that we did there called Trading with the Piscataway, or Piscataway, depending on how you pronounce it, but it's a tribe of Native Americans that lived in the area, that we, as soon as I started researching on them and like their culture and the way they were, I got so hooked, because they were doing food-wise like everything that we were doing. I mean, they were not nomadic, so they like stayed, you know, in one place, but they're the ones that invented the Three Sisters, the growing style, 10,000 years ago. I mean, figuring out that if you grow beans, corn, and squash all at the same, like they create a symbiotic relationship, putting nutrients to the ground, taking out, you know, the corn grows up, you know, becomes lattice work for the beans, and the squash create ground cover. These guys figured that out without doing soil samples. You know, like this is just something they figured out on their own. But they would forage through, you know, marshland for, you know, food that they ate, exactly like what we were doing. That might sound weird to say marshland, but that's things like ramps and duck and wild rice. I mean, all that kind of stuff. But the one thing that just blew my mind and everything was that, you guys have, if you've never been to Patamac Farm, it's situated up on this giant hill. And if you're in the dining room, you're looking down into this valley and then up Point of Rocks on the other side. And in the middle of the valley is the Potomac River, which runs for miles and miles and miles. Absolutely beautiful. But there's a bridge, this beautiful bridge that goes across the Potomac River in the distance. And where the bridge met the shoreline, there used to be a market there where settlers would trade with the Piscataway Native Americans. And it, if you were to say place of trade, which is what they called it, a place of trade, you would say Patamac, which means place of trade in their language, the name of our farm and where the name Potomac came from for the entire Potomac River. Yeah. How incredible is that?
Cool, man.
So, yeah. So it created this, it was the first course, you know, every course had a story at, you know, all of them did, but the first course, but all the dishes were based off of things that the settlers ate and the things that the Native Americans would eat. And we would kind of cross them, cross back and forth and that kind of thing. And we even had like, you know, sight and aroma. Yeah, like one of the dishes was like oysters with hay, and we would sprinkle a small amount of like natural tobacco in there and torch it and like put a cap on it. So when it got to the table, it was the last one of the dishes that he described, and they would take the lid off and a little puff of smoke would come out, because in that place of trade, it smelled like tobacco and fire and that kind of thing.
Oh, rad, man.
When we started, we had like pelts on the table to really kind of put the whole thing in there, but like vegans really hated that part, so we stopped that.
But, let me ask you this.
Lovely table but, of death.
Are you leaning more towards trying to stick to Native American ingredients, or are you just going all over the world and using whatever you want?
No, I'm sorry. So I'm being very long-winded now. I'm sorry. I'm trying not to ramble too much, but what I was trying to get at. And
you're golden.
Okay.
That's literally why you're here.
This is where it all comes back. This is where it all comes back to the woodlands. It's just that what we're doing now, like we're doing this research and we're having our minds blown on some real aspects that we're really going to incorporate into a story going through the whole dining experience that we're going to create. And, it's a level of delving into this type of research that was born in our time at the Woodlands. You know, like when we did these, I'm sure you remember like those themed menus that we changed every month, the tasting menu.
Yeah.
You know, we did, but it wasn't just like, you know, a stupid theme or a lame theme. Like one of the themes, one of my favorites was the monk menu.
I was just
going to
say that. That was one of my
favorites.
I love
that. That was so cool. I want to do it again. But like all the ingredients were from different abbeys and monasteries all over the world. We did pretzel. Remember we did like pretzels? Because pretzels come from there. Yeah, we had that monastery down the road. I mean, It was so cool. We did the AOC, DOC menu where we used like ingredients that were all like protected, and we had a story to tell. I mean, like we had stories that went along with it. So like when you sat down and did the monk menu, like we talked about monasteries and like how they all survived. I mean, chartreuse, remember doing
chartreuse.
Yeah, the story of chartreuse is fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
Only
and when
like
you're like
two people on earth know it, the rest of the
earth on the planet, you're right, it's so fucking cool.
So much.
Yeah, and so like when you eat something that has chartreuse in it and you're like tell even a small smidgen of the chartreuse story, people's jaws drop and it makes something, you're eating something completely different. So
those
like
stories
we're really,
are what's so cool and it, so intriguing yeah. to so many people, and like
it gives things meaning.
People are looking for more than, you know, just to get full and satisfy and satiety for themselves. Like they want more for their discretionary income. Like you're competing against so many other like theaters and movies and like amusement parks. Like people spend a lot of money and they want a little more for their money, and having that story behind it and being able to tell and
see. You remember something like that. You remember it. Like you remember it for a long time.
It. You might not remember the dish, but you'll never forget that story.
Patrick O'Connell's Five Stages of Dining, man. That's the last one, is like, you know, remembering it the next day. And from then on, it becomes a memory. Like we want to try and create that.
Memories.
You know, and the thing is, you touched on something interesting, because one of my most disappointing Michelin 3-star meals that I've ever had was at 11 Madison Park. And the reason is because there wasn't a consistent or coherent theme throughout the night. It was a bunch of stuff that was technically executed.
You heard they're going plant-based now?
I heard that.
Yeah,
that's weird.
I just announced that.
Yeah, that's it. I heard it 2 days ago. But like I'm not going to shed a tear. Because it was hellaciously expensive, which I don't have a problem with. I am not very value conscious. You guys know this.
It's expensive.
But it didn't tell a story. I was in New York for like 3 days. And the day before we went to 11 Madison Park, maybe it was the day after, we went to Le Bernardin. And Le Bernardin was completely consistent and coherent. You could totally tell that the chef's vision was absolutely driving what was going on. Whereas at 11 Madison Park, it seems to be more like all they were thinking about was let's pull out all the stops and be as nice as we can be. But nice restaurant isn't a genre. It's not a theme. It didn't tell a story. Individual dishes had their own themes, but the themes did not come together. It was like an anthology. It was like a short story collection by a bunch of different authors. And I'm much more impressed when a restaurant can have a very cohesive vision of what they are. Like when you sit down and from the very first glass of something that you drink, all the way to the last thing you eat is part of one whole thing rather than a bunch of separate things. That really resonates with me. And so it sounds like what you're doing is definitely in line with that.
Yeah. You should, I mean, you like, if you like throwing some money, I know it's a bit of a big expense, but like, I'd love to go with you too. I would love to go back to the Fat Duck. They are doing some absolutely crazy stuff right now. Have you seen the Mad Hatter?
No,
I haven't been there since they did the renovation.
I haven't
seen the Mad Hatter chorus. Have you not seen that?
No,
I've heard of it.
It's mock turtle soup, but it's all like done like the Mad Hatter. They have like a clear teapot. You can find this on YouTube. Just like Google Fat Duck with Mad Hatter chorus or whatever. But like they reduced a consomme down to like brick form. I mean, it's like, and they molded it into like a watch, and then they wrapped it in gold, and it's on a chain. I don't know if you remember the story of the Mad Hatter or Alice in Wonderland. So they're like hot water in the tea kettle. They put the watch in the tea kettle. The consomme dissolves, becomes the broth in the bowl. Is there? I mean, I don't want, like, Google it. Watch it on YouTube. Absolutely amazing. I mean, oh my God, the ice wine. I don't know how they named it, but one of the desserts, it's all based off the, what's the name of the infection on Botrytis similia, I think it's called?
Botrytis cinerea.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's all based off that. It looks like a bunch of grapes, but all the different spheres or something different. So, so fucking dope, man. But just to get on to what you were just saying, like how a dinner, a longer progression menu like that, how it has like a cohesion throughout everything instead of like individual parts. I agree, and I think that when it's done incorrectly, how like every course is just wrong, there's no flow up and down, or it's all just kind of modular, or just kind of, or the intense things are in the beginning and kills everything after, you know. The Fat Duck is one. They're very modern. I mean, there's a lot of different examples, but like, they're just one right now that I really like the way that they play with things. Like, everything has a story to it, and they're very playful with it. I think it's
really
cool.
I definitely want to go. We should definitely do that.
Yeah, dude, we should. I mean, I love to do some like food eating, man. I want to go down and eat some Lennox Hassie's food, you know, off of open fire for like really bad.
I just tried to get Nate to go to New York with me on the fly, but he has responsibilities.
He's got kids and, you know, family.
Yeah, what happened? I had planned a trip with Dee, and we were going to go, and then there was an issue with a medication that she's on that makes her vaccine not effective, and we found this out.
Oh.
I guess we found that out the easy way. I'd rather find that out by reading about it than by finding out about it at the doctor's office.
Fuck, man. Poor thing. I'm sorry. Yeah.
She's fine. She just has to be really careful. Which is the thing is, this might all be solved in 2 weeks, but it was just too quick. So Nate and I was like, Nate, come to New York, and he was like, I'll try. And then 4 days later, 3 days later, he's like, it's just not going to happen. I was like, yeah, I know.
Man, that would have been awesome, though.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is that another thing about the 11 Madison Park experience that really resonated with me in kind of a negative way is that at this point, they had kind of a pretentious concept going on. They were claiming that their tasting menu was composed on the fly. Like, they were talking about how, you know, the
different... Oh, it's not.
Of course it's not. Yeah. But they had all these, like, you know, the dish would just be like veal mushroom, but the servers were clearly told to say that it was composed on the fly, and there was this foretop of these. It was two like professional Indian dudes, they were yuppies. I mean, they had shirts and ties. They were both about 30, and they were with one of their parents. So it was like this Indian family of four, and this guy. I wanted to send him a glass of champagne because he was not having it. So, like, the girl's trying to describe the concept, and he just goes, ma'am, I'm not going to do his accent because I can't do an Indian accent. It would sound disrespectful. But also because I love this guy. I'm not making fun of him at all. He goes, ma'am, that cannot possibly be true. Of course they have dishes. I'm just asking what they're going to be. And the girl, I looked at her, and she had, like, flop sweat. She was like, I could read her thoughts. Her thoughts were, I told the chef this was going to happen, and he said to do it anyway. And I had to because he's Daniel Hum. That was another part of what contributed to that being kind of a weak meal. I feel like concept is everything. Like, the best restaurants in the world know exactly what they're about, and they're all about it.
I love Madison. I think it was like 13 years ago. I mean, it was a long, long time ago. I mean, They had a name, but they weren't anywhere near what they are now. And I remember it being, it was good. I enjoyed it. I just remember saying, like, I'm glad I'm not the one paying right now. And if I was, I would be not okay. I wouldn't be happy with that.
I mean,
I had a great meal there about 13 years ago, right when he was starting to hit his stride in New York.
Yeah.
He wasn't quite a 4-star restaurant. It was an excellent meal. But then he just kind of started, I don't know.
I mean, they get just a little high on his own.
I wonder if there's gonna be like a price change going plant based.
Oh, I would, you know? I would imagine that there would have to be. I mean, you're just not going to be able to get people to pay for.
I respect that idea. I think it's a cool decision. I think it also kind of brings him back in the limelight a little bit too, which I'm sure was part of the decision. But
the place clearly has all the talent in the world. So maybe
have you guys ever eaten vegan?
Yeah. Dee's pretty much a pesca vegan all the time. Fish and vegan. So I don't.
It's a different volume to feel satiated.
Yeah,
you know, like you can eat 8 ounces of beef and feel satiated. You know, like you eat 8 ounces of plant, you're gonna need like 8 more. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, so I'm just wondering if like how they take that into account doing a progression menu like that. You know,
I'm very curious to see what happens. Having said that, I don't think I'm gonna go unless the, you know, the Michelin reviews come out and it's just soaring praise. I'm, you know, yeah. That's just. Like, it's a lot of money for a place that already kind of disappointed me once. But I am curious to see what they do. I think that them pivoting to a situation where they actually like have something that they can sort of hang their style on, give their style a backbone, because clearly the place has all the funding in the world, and the chef has all the talent in the world. So I think that maybe a new idea can be a turning point for them. Like, that would be super cool. But I say turning point. This is a Michelin 3-star restaurant. I feel like I'm the only guy in the world that didn't like it. It was like There's Something About Mary. I was like, am I the only person that thought this movie sucked?
Well, wait, what? Something you didn't like? Something About Mary?
This is exactly what I'm saying.
But I do like recharging. You know, like Alinea, what they're doing now is completely different than what they were doing when that first book came out. I mean, The French Laundry is an example of something that still does something perfect and over the top and amazing. Like, you can go to The French Laundry now and you like have an idea like what's going to happen. And, you know, nine times out of 10 going to have a good exam.
French Laundry has evolved incredibly. I'm currently working on a review of their new book, including cooking some recipes out of it, which is, let me tell you, difficult and expensive. Like, the difficulty level of these dishes is extreme, and I'm doing this out of my home kitchen. The evolutionary steps they have taken are really impressive. Like, they have continued to grow and pivot. And one thing that I thought was super cool is that a lot of the stuff they're doing now is stuff we were doing at the Woodlands 10 years ago.
Dude, have you heard of the restaurant Franzen? I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. Frantzen.
No.
Definitely check that out. That is a new cookbook for your roster that is phenomenal. Nathan Shapiro got it, was telling me about it. I looked it up. I'm ordering it today. Their food is looking insanely good, and the experience looks insanely good.
Where's the place?
It's in Sweden. They're 3 Michelin in Sweden. They're kind of keeping a little trendy with a lot of what 3 Michelin European restaurants are doing. I mean, you kind of see a lot of the same concepts flowing around, but the way they do what they're doing is, it looks absolutely breathtaking.
I would definitely check it out. Sometimes trends are awesome.
Yeah, for example, tarts. Like, I've been seeing like a lot of, you know, that level of restaurant, you know, doing a lot of tarts, you know, like just kind of eats like little savory tarts and that kind of stuff. But like, I'm not knocking it. Don't get me wrong. Like, little tarts like this, like I could eat my weight in, you know, a pile of them, you know, don't get me wrong. I like seeing, you know, more originality, but I don't want to sound snobby at all.
No.
I love tarts. Don't take that the wrong way. Check out Franzen. Like, there's some YouTube videos of people dining there. You can kind of really get an example. They do this one course with truffle. All it is like a piece of perfect, very airy brioche that they let stale a little bit, toast in butter on all sides. And it's like this whipped Parmesan cream butter. And then they come to the table and like shave like mountains of truffles over it.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God. I mean, like, it's pretty dope. You got to check it out.
That sounds awesome. I mean, the thing is, you see these trends happen, and it's nothing new. Like, I remember after Momofuku hit, when they hit so hard, all of a sudden everybody was doing a ramen bowl. Everybody. Really, a little more down market, but you know what I mean. Or like, after The French Laundry hit so hard, there was a period. but like, I remember after the first French Laundry cookbook came out, everyone and their dog had to have a foie gras course. And like, I'm super pro foie gras.
Do not
get me wrong. But there was a point of time where literally every fine dining restaurant, whether or not they were French, had a foie gras course. And unfortunately, a lot of times it was a sauteed foie gras with fruit course. And it was like, guys, there's a lot of other things that you could be doing. Like, there's other proteins in the world.
I got sick of it.
Yeah,
like, it expected, like, you have to have foie gras, you had to have truffle, you know, like, you had to have lobster, you know, that kind of thing.
And
in that era, you know, but like, yeah, I got sick of it.
You had luxury ingredients too.
I'll tell you Grant Achatz was annoyed that they didn't have foie gras at Topolobampo. Now, Topolobampo is a 4-star at the time Mexican restaurant in Chicago, and we all went, and he was like, he's like, they didn't have foie gras. It's like, this is a Mexican restaurant. Like, Mexican cuisine, they had wheat locoche. They had, you know, they had interesting ingredients. It was an incredibly cool handmade meal. Although I do think it was beneath the 4-star level. I think they were kind of playing on Rick Bayless's fame a little bit. Bayless's other restaurant, Frontera Grill. So I think that it was maybe a little bit overrated. I mean that in the literal sense, and it had a higher rating than it should have because he's so well known. But having said that, it was also perfectly good. And I was like, Grant, this is okay. He was so annoyed that they didn't have foie. And I was just like, that shows the how powerful the French Laundry mentality was. I mean, I had an attitude after I read the French Laundry cookbook that if it wasn't in that book, it didn't matter. And I thought
that iconic
for years. It took me a while to get over that. Actually, honestly, dude, it kind of carried me to Woodlands when I was working with you guys. You were pulling out these ingredients I'd never seen before. And I'm like,
yeah,
okay, I should start paying attention more.
Dude, that little snippet where he had, like, the importance of staff meal, the one that was like importance of rabbits. I had an experience like that when I was working at the inn where I hit a deer and like I felt horrible and I put the deer out of its misery on the side of this like dark country road in the middle of the night. I did not burn a piece of meat. I did not like waste anything. My need to make sure that like I didn't waste protein never went away from that. Like that little bit about the importance of rabbits, every single, not just professional cook, but home cook, anyone who eats should read that. Knowing where it comes from and like when, and knowing what it took to get a protein on your plate is a very big deal.
People are so disconnected from where food comes from.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when I talk
we had, about- I mean, it's not just like a cute, and the fact that it's like a cute bunny, like that's, that kind of makes it a little bit more powerful. But like, at Patamac Farm a couple years ago, we got these huge snapping turtles. I mean, like the size of car tires. I don't know if you guys have ever messed with these, with those things. They can be very tasty. But like, I mean, if you find a snapping turtle and you dispatch it and start cooking it, it's going to taste bad. Like you need to like purge. Like, so we like, we had these snapping turtles and we put them in like clean water. We were like changing the water out all the time. So they kind of like purge a lot of that muddy flavor. But the way that you dispatch a turtle is, I mean, they are dinosaurs.
Yeah.
I don't know if I should go into this, but like my point is that when you end the life of something that you're going to eat, it changes you. Like the first time it happens, like it changes you. Like the importance of rabbits from Thomas Keller is intense. I mean, he's like smashing a rabbit, you know, on the head to like make something to eat. The way that you dispatch a snapping turtle is you hold giant pliers open and you just kind of slowly go towards the turtle's mouth and he will snap on the pliers and then you close the pliers down so he can't bite you anymore and then do the whole thing. And
wow,
it's interesting. We used to freak people out too. Like a turtle heart would beat for like 3 days in the refrigerator.
Whoa.
What?
Yeah. So we would freaking freak out like waiters and stuff. You know, like feel it. It's still beating.
I like it. We just pivoted from profound respect for life and nature to scare the hell out of cooks.
I know. Damn it. I just ruined everything. I just ruined everything I just said.
It's okay. But it freaking out cooks is important. Like I remember, I don't remember where this was. I think it was at Peninsula Hotel way back in the day. We had cleaned 2 cases of rabbits, so we had this bucket of rabbit livers. So we labeled it bunny guts. And the little tiny pastry assistant, because there's always a little tiny pastry assistant, she was like the Chicago version of Ashley Kennedy. She went back into the
I was about to say if you remember Ashley, the little dragon.
So she comes out and she's like, "What's in that big bucket marked bunny guts?" And the sous chef's like, "Bunny guts." And she's like, "Come on, Charlie, really?" And he's like, "Yeah, bunny guts." And she's like, "What is it really?" And I was like, "It's literally bunny guts." And she just goes, "Oh," and walked away whimpering. when I was talking about
that. I mean, well, like what you talked about too, like we goof around, but we have profound respect for
our
coworkers and the ingredients. Like if we're screwing around with you, it's because we love you.
Yeah.
And if we don't love you, we're not going to talk to you. We're not going to give you any the time of day. And it's same with the ingredients. Like,
And
it's only from a good place.
Yeah, and when I was talking about how the French Laundry cookbook had kind of a little bit of a negative effect, I wasn't saying anything bad about the book itself. Like the fact that the book was so iconic is why it had such an effect. And I mean, like, that changed the way that I blanched green vegetables forever. And the only reason
Like, that changed people's lives, dude.
Yeah, like, officially, but before that, if I saw somebody blanching some asparagus in a skillet, I'd think, why is he doing that? Oh, well. After that, if I saw somebody blanching asparagus in a skillet, I'd be like, you're an idiot. Like,
you're a goddamn puddle blancher. Yeah. Get a big puddle on, you donkey.
Yeah, so
puddle blancher.
Yeah, Nate used to get so mad.
I barely blanch vegetables at all anymore.
Yep. You just go right into the oil?
Yeah, dude, Heston had this whole thing on research of fat-soluble and water-soluble flavors in vegetables, man. It's very rare that I ever let vegetables touch water at all.
Huh.
Now, I mean, so, like, asparagus will never touch a blanching pot ever again.
I learned that from you.
I learned it from, well, we did it. We learned it together.
Yeah, okay.
We did it, man.
People don't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. I just did the asparagus recipe out of the Alain Passard cookbook just to check it out, and I borrowed it from Nate, and it involves standing asparagus up in like a half an inch of clarified, but maybe an inch and a half of clarified butter, and then cooking it like that for an hour and a half, basting it slowly. So what happened?
Green asparagus or white?
Green. And the interesting thing about this, I did the recipe because I didn't think it was going to work. I was like, that's a terrible idea. Obviously, I have to do it. You know, it was $10 worth of asparagus. It wasn't a big deal. But what happens
is... So look, when you tie it together, is it like a little hockey puck kind of size or like long?
It's like a bundle and you stand the bundle up in the pan.
One bundle was really hard to keep standing. I should have done two bundles, like two bunches together. But you just trim the bottoms off just like you do. You don't peel it. And then you set it in the hot butter and then put the butter on a low flame for an hour and a half. Spooning the butter over the top, and what happens is the bottom gets really like army green, like it totally loses its color just like you'd expect, but the top that's just barely had hot butter hit it just warms up but stays bright green and raw. So when you break it out, each spear gets more and more cooked as you get towards the woody end. So the top end is
interesting,
like beautiful raw perfect asparagus with just a little butter and salt on it, and the bottom is totally
soft. That's interesting. That's really
And then, you know, gets soft.
Alain Passard's vegetables are fascinating.
I really had a lot of fun with that cookbook.
His parent, like, I can't remember which book it was, but he did like, he was talking about pairing the pears with parsnips. No, he talks about the pairing of like orange and beets, but he's talking about like pears and parsnips, I believe it was. And like did this whole preparation of like pears and parsnips. Butter and like ham. It was unbelievably good. Unbelievably good.
He's a legend.
Dude, the French Laundry cookbook changed lives. Like I will always cherish the time that I got to stage there, and seeing that part of California is Yountville is absolutely breathtaking. That was a long time ago. I think like Bouchon Bakery had just opened up. No, the bakery's there. Yeah, they just opened the bakery like right next door or whatever, but that place, what they do, continue to do now, like changes people's lives. But that book will always be one of the best things that's ever happened to me.
I need to make my pilgrimage. I need to go there one time.
Let's hit up Smiley and go say what's up. Get him drunk.
Yeah, yeah. Just go say what's up and make my pilgrimage and just say thank you to Chef Keller if I see him.
For real.
I've never met the guy, but he's had such an important factor on my life too.
I mean, all of us.
There's countless people who can say that.
The dude is to contemporary American cuisine what Eddie Van Halen is to guitar solos. Like
you got that right.
Like, you know, he's the guy that was an absolute game changer, and he was around for a long time, and he evolved a lot, and he changed a lot. But his contribution is endless, absolutely endless. And I think we have enough for an episode, but before we break up, TK, you want to do this again?
Yeah, I'm down, dude. I was one of the things from the Woodlands too that I really hit home was like finding like-minded people that just really enjoy talking about food. Like, and like, just like you were saying, like, there's so many snobby chefs and cooks out there that you know, like even like young guys that just got out of school or they just started and they think like 1 year in the job and they're going to be on the next episode of Chef's Table. Like, you know, I like finding humble people that really enjoy food and learning. You will never, ever learn everything there is. So like, I loved talking to people like you guys, man. I love you guys. Yeah.
Well, you're welcome to come back on anytime you want, because this has been one of the easiest to record episodes that we have done. Just because you got so much to say. And of course, us sitting around and talking about food, it's amazing how quickly we dropped back into it.
Well, and it's a big reason we started this podcast, because there are so few like-minded people that we don't have anybody to talk to. And
yeah, exactly. It's like exactly.
Nobody that wants to, that actually enjoys what we do and what we talk about, like, and even professionals. It's like a lot of them are just kind of like snobby. They think they know it.
Jaded. It's like everything sucks. Yeah.
Man, this used to be cool. Yeah. We don't have anybody to talk to anymore.
I know, man.
Even back in the day, this coworker looked over at me and he's like, I'm just not one of those guys that can go home and read cookbooks. And I was like, then why are you here?
Yeah.
Get the fuck out of here. Get the fuck out.
Like, go home.
It's, honestly,
you can go ahead and get your stuff and get out of here.
if you're not here for the love of learning, then why are you here? Because we work really hard and we don't.
It ain't for the money.
Like
it ain't for the money. Yeah.
Yeah. Love it or leave it. Tarver, thank you so much for coming and hanging out with us.
Thank you.
My absolute pleasure. I love you guys, man. Love you guys. I was going to say something, too, about the music that you guys play. Okay. It reminds me. I know it's not the same, but it reminds me of Chefs of the World. Do you remember that show?
Yeah.
Back in the day.
Oh, my God. Great chefs. It reminds me. Holy shit.
Yeah. Yeah, it reminds me of that. That's awesome.
I used to watch that show after school every day. I would sit there with my notepad, and I would take notes.
Yeah. Every single day I watch that show. Yeah, so good.
The girl that did the voiceover had an accent like she was from Mississippi, which is such a weird show. Yeah. So the thing is, the chef she was talking to would be like Freddy Girardet, like total European beasts. And
beasts. Yeah.
And
one day my mom told me I got so pissed off. She was out in the kitchen and I was watching it and they cut to the dessert and I was like, what about the sauce? You didn't give me the sauce. What the hell? You didn't give me the sauce recipe. My mom told me about that. And I was like, well, yeah, I wanted to learn.
the music that we play for the outro is actually my old band from college called Speakeasy. I was about 19.
Really?
Yeah, so.
No shit.
That's me on tenor saxophone.
No shit, really? Yeah. That's awesome, man.
The thing is, that was it was a professionally produced demo because the guy that was in charge of the band he was a software engineer / programmer, so he had a decent amount of money. And so he took us into a real studio. And that's actually the reason I know as much about recording as I do is because of that experience. I spent a week and a half in a studio cutting a demo.
Cool, man.
Yeah, Tarver King, thank you so much for joining us. We hope to have you back on the podcast. Every week for the
rest. Yeah, absolute pleasure, man.
We're always invited back, and we can keep on talking about great stuff. This has been so much fun.
I'm a big fan.
Best episode ever.
Speakeasy.
I want to hear more Nate rage as the episodes proceed. You guys have some really good information about it. Like hearing the Nate.
Oh, I can always get Nate stirred up.
Jesse knows how to rattle my cage.
Oh my God. I just started thinking of some things. Never mind.
I'm just good at rattling cages in general. Nate's and Cherie's are my two favorite cages to rattle.
Please don't rattle Cherie's cage anymore.
Her bite is much worse than her bite.
Much worse. Like much worse.
I'm all talk.
I've had to physically run from Cherie before.
I know. She loves you, man. You're good. Don't worry. She loves you.
I love her too. I remember at one point, like I made some great catch, like a nine pan was falling and I reached out and snagged it. And I never make the catch. I'm like the clumsiest person in the world.
And oh,
I,
no.
I grabbed it and I was like, ha, I'm yeah. cat, I'm cat-like. And then she yeah. looks over and goes, you're fucking Garfield-like. And I was just like, awesome. Oh, God damn it.
That's awesome.
All right. Well, we are way
thanks,
past,
guys.
We are way past out of time, so Stinkies is going to play us out of here. I have been Joseph Sutton. This has been Nate Whiting, and our guest has been Tarver Super King King. We'll explain that nickname on another episode. It's a pretty good story. So, guys, thanks everyone so much for listening, and we look forward to doing these again.
All right, thanks, everybody.
I'm Gillen, guys. Thank you, man.
Absolutely.